You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the latest on COVID-19 with new booster vaccines on the way, plus new research on the impacts of long COVID. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about home.
Feeling like you're different from your peers can have a big impact on your self-acceptance. But as Miriam Brabham of Green Bay tells us, a nurturing community helped her learn how to love her hair. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
When I was young, I hated my hair. It spent most of its time tightly pulled into lopsided buns, surrounded by a halo of curly flyaways. In those early years, my curls were traumatized. They were dehydrated and unappreciated, and they were a visual reminder of what I didn't know and how I didn't fit in. As a multi-ethnic Black girl who was also a Messianic Jew, 9-year-old me saw my curls as yet another thing that othered me. At a North Chicago YMCA, I would watch the other girls after swim class with envy. Passing small combs through their wet, straight hair, they would sigh and huff as they started from the top of their heads and found resistance at the ends. These girls would finish detangling their whole head in 5 minutes. After swim class, I didn't have time to wash my thick hair. While the smell of Pantene and Suave filled the air, I used the water to help me gather my curls into an outstretched scrunchie. These rebellious curls, stinking of chlorine and a lack of information, would begin to clump together into impossible knots, almost as if they were so suffocated by the world that they coiled together for comfort. I hated my hair. It was time, effort, and a major contributor to my imposter syndrome collection. Not white enough, not Black enough, not Jewish enough, and yet too much. As I got older, the war with my hair became bitter. Temporary dyes, perms, and massive amounts of heat were met with split ends, chemical burns, and tension alopecia. Big chop after big chop left me at a shady hair braiding salon under the tracks on the north side of Chicago, where a woman used nail glue instead of hair glue and some overpriced box braids. Cutting out multiple braids, explaining why you shouldn't say good hair, and having monoracial people laugh at my ignorance left trauma residue all over my coils. The age of peace began when I started talking nice to my hair, instead of verbally berating it and subsequently myself. I learned so much about my hair while studying abroad in Botswana, Africa. The people were not shy or reserved in their comments and suggestions. They also didn't see me as separate from themselves. I just didn't know how to do my hair. The Botswana people taught me to love myself and my hair. I began to see my curls as an intrinsic part of myself. These curls can be playful springs that bounce in a sweet summer breeze. They can be strong, wide coils that keep the moisture to themselves and observe the world from scarves that set them on high. These curls can refuse to be tamed. They can go their own way, laughing at edge control and headbands alike. They can lay gently around my face. These curls define themselves and can easily change depending on the day and humidity. They have personality, and not shockingly, it's very similar to my own. So yes, there is trauma wrapped up in these curls. But like trauma in any of us, I am healing with love, time, and hair oil.
Miriam Brabham is a multicultural student success manager at UW Green Bay. And her story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the numbers aren't huge, but there's been an uptick in the number of COVID cases and hospitalizations this summer. Helix, the company that's helped the CDC keep track of virus variants, has seen cases rise at least 30% from June to July, from a pretty low starting point. We're talking about why we may be seeing this uptick, what it might mean for the fall, and we'll look at the new booster vaccine expected for this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or anyone you know had COVID recently? What do you want to know about current case numbers and the fall boosters? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
What are we seeing in COVID numbers when it comes to cases and hospitalizations lately?
Yeah, well, since June, right about when schools closed for the year and summer travel season began, wastewater surveillance and people taking trips to emergency departments around the country, all those data indicated that cases were beginning to increase. And around mid-July, hospitalizations also began to increase. And we haven't seen an increase in deaths yet, but that's something to monitor and see what might happen in the coming weeks to months.
And to put things in perspective, we're not at this point anyway returning to the bad old days with really high numbers of hospitalizations. Do I have that right?
That's right. There is a lot of immunity out there, but some of that immunity that came from maybe a past infection and from boosters, which were, offered beginning last fall, and a lot of that immunity begins to wane. And as people are gathering and traveling and seeing each other, you get this recipe for more spread.
One of the big questions here, is this a summertime blip or is this foreshadowing maybe a bigger seasonal increase in the fall? What are we watching for to see what the answer is going to be?
Yeah, again, it's not surprising that it's increasing because people are increasingly returning to normal, traveling, moving around, seeing each other. Obviously, most people are not wearing masks. Some people are, and that's great for their to reduce their personal risk, but most people aren't. There is a lot of immunity to help protect people, but that wanes over time. And so coming into the fall, it's a good time to, begin talking about the next booster that will be available.
I want to get into the booster in just a moment, but I want to talk about who might still be vulnerable as COVID numbers pick up a little bit. As you mentioned, a lot of people vaccinated. A lot of people may have had a prior infection, were mostly less susceptible, but it seems like there's a group of people in many cases vaccinated, but vulnerable because of a combination of age and pre-existing health conditions. Who should we be watching for the most when it comes to vulnerability to a new bump up in COVID numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the people at risk for severe COVID are going to be those who are immunocompromised. For them, the vaccines don't take as well as someone whose immune systems are more intact. People who are elderly as well, simply because with age comes a decline in one's immunity and ability to mount an immune response. And like you said, somebody who has lots of comorbidities is at risk for severe disease. And all of those individuals really should do what they can to prevent getting an infection.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID news, including, as you mentioned, Ajay, a new fall line of boosters coming out, I think anticipated to hit the health clinics and more in September, likely. There's some changes in the design in these new vaccines. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we have had the bivalent booster, where half the vaccine is the ancestral strain, the original strain of SARS-CoV-2. And then added in there was the variant at the time when those boosters were developed, the BA.5 variant. In the fall, we're not going to have a bivalent booster. We're going to have a booster with just the latest strain, XBB.1.5. And the XBB variant, the family of variants, are circulating. And so it'll give people the most protection against what's circulating at the moment.
Looking at these variants, as I understand it, well, first of all, you mentioned the ancestral, the original COVID. We're not so much seeing that anymore. It's these newer variants. Why this 1.5? I gather it isn't, a dominant strain right now, but is it similar enough to, I guess, the variety, the grab bag of different variants out there that it should be helpful?
Yeah, the recommendation for XBB 1.5 is because that's where the data are from. That's what's been evaluated, and it mounts a good immune response when boosted with that. Sure, it is on a decline and being replaced with other variants in the XBB family, but they are very similar to one another. So the immune system won't have such a different response, whether it's XBB 1.5 or something else in that family.
People might be listening thinking, okay, well, should I get a new booster? Shouldn't I? I don't know. Who would be at the top of your list for people who should answer that question? Yes, and probably as soon as you can.
Yeah, the CDC is going to make a recommendation on who should get boosted. And the expectation, of course, is anybody who's elderly, immunocompromised, people at most risk. For the general population who don't fall in those categories, we'll see what the CDC recommends. If somebody's indicated, certainly they should get boosted.
One big question all along, and I don't know if there's an answer yet, is COVID going to become a seasonal illness? Like we know in Wisconsin, roughly when cold and flu is going to come along. Has COVID settled into a pattern like that, or is that still a big question mark?
Yeah, still a question mark. It hasn't been seasonal yet. I mean, the summer uptick is an example where we wouldn't expect to see a lot of respiratory virus transmission in the summer, and yet we're seeing this uptick. Maybe it's an early increase for what's about to come in the fall. Maybe it'll decline and then it'll peak later. We haven't seen a seasonal pattern. And, as an epidemiologist, I say we need a few seasons before we can declare something as seasonal. So for now, I think just keeping track of cases, hospitalizations are important and see where the rises may be occurring.
And getting back to vaccinations before I let you go, Ajay, a lot of people got the original vaccines. It seems like there's been a diminishing return in terms of the number of people getting successive boosters, pretty low uptake in the scope of things for the latest round. Are you hopeful that more people will seize on the opportunity for this new one in the fall?
Yeah, I hope so. There's a lot of immunity out there. Over 96% of people have antibodies to this virus, whether it came from vaccines, whether it came from an infection, or a combination of both. A lot of people who have had recent infection might not feel motivated to get a booster since they have immunity from that form. But all immunity wanes, so it's important to maybe have a conversation with your doctor and discuss what your individual vulnerability is and whether the booster is right for you. And of course, if it's recommended, there's a reason for it, why it's recommended for you, and it's a good idea to get it.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor, Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about a recent increase in COVID cases and some upcoming vaccine boosters. Coming up, a lot of people who have had COVID-19 experience longer-term symptoms. We'll check out some new research on long COVID. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about longer-term impacts of COVID? Have you experienced them? Are you experiencing them yourself or someone in your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about COVID-19. Now we're taking a look at a new analysis of patients with long COVID. Long COVID is the third most common neurological condition in the United States. It continues to be a problem long after the worst of the pandemic went away. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to share an experience you had with longer-term impacts of COVID-19, or if you have a question about diagnosis, treatment, research on long COVID. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Mark Sala is an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and co-director of the Northwestern Medicine Comprehensive COVID-19 Center, which provides care for and conducts research on long COVID. Dr. Sala, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sorry, we had a line get crossed there. Sorry about that, Dr. Sala. So first of all, can you talk about this study? You treat patients with long COVID there at Northwestern. This study looks at more than 1,800 patients who have been treated there. What are some of the most significant things you found?
Thanks for highlighting this. So indeed, so our COVID recovery center, this comprehensive COVID center that we have at our hospital system here, what we've done is during really the early phases of the pandemic, we tried to take in as many individuals as we could who had persistent symptoms from the virus. Usually we define that as over 30 days after the infection, having persistent or new symptoms that can be attributed to COVID. And so in our circumstance, our paper describes really kind of our configuration of our center, what we found to be helpful in case other hospitals or systems across the country might find that valuable. And then the other component to our manuscript here is we really take a look at those 1,802 people and just kind of explain which different specialties among our 12 different specialties who take care of these individuals at our center. What was it like for, did people need to see more neurology, more pulmonology, more cardiology, and a lot of those practice patterns? And some of the conclusions there were that 85% of the people that we did see at our center needed to see either neurology, cardiology, or pulmonology, respectively. And those are predominantly where people have most of their persistent symptoms, as it turns out, with a smattering of other specialties involved, including ENT, dermatology, GI, for other ailments. And then when we looked at categories of types of people that we saw, we tried to really separate those out who were in the ICU versus those who maybe were in the hospital but not critically ill, and then those who were not hospitalized. And in fact, 80% of our entire cohort of people were never hospitalized for their illness of acute COVID. And we found that when doctors made decisions about what types of tests they needed, so as a pulmonologist, if I see someone who has persistent shortness of breath after COVID or maybe a cough that just won't go away, when we order directed testing like CT scans, pulmonary function testing, a really high proportion of people end up having abnormalities on those tests. So for an example, someone who was maybe never hospitalized for their COVID infection, just as one example here, we can see sometimes one in five people who are not hospitalized for COVID might have CT scan abnormalities that show some sign of inflammation or fibrosis in their lung tissue. So the point of our, the punchline really of kind of our paper and our findings was that multiple eyes from multiple specialties on these individuals who have persistent ailments, it tends to benefit them to have a lot of different doctors looking at them in the setting.
And that speaks, I think, to the pernicious nature of COVID-19, especially including in its long COVID form. At first we thought, oh, this is, you know, a particularly bad, but this is a respiratory virus. The virus did a lot of different things to different bodily systems. And that sounds like that's playing out in what you're seeing in long COVID.
Yeah, I mean, one might argue that, in fact, while the most severe morbidity and mortality that came about early in the pandemic was indeed pneumonia and the consequences from it, but that the longer lasting issues now are mainly manifestations such as brain fog, cognition problems, and really just profound fatigue for a lot of people. So the landscape has changed. I mean, vaccines and how the virus mutated changed a lot of what we've been seeing. But yeah, you're right, though. I mean, the myriad ways in which this has afflicted people and for the time and trajectory is been otherwise pretty unexpected.
Let's bring on a caller. Jessica is with us in Appleton. Jessica, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Jessica?
So I just wanted to talk about, like, my experience with COVID. And honestly, like, it's been 3 years since I had it, and my life has changed dramatically for the worse. You know, my brain fog, I'm fatigued, and it's not just those things. It's also that, like, when I get sick now, I get really sick. I am, like, laid up in bed from colds. Like, our immune system is not a muscle that we need to flex. Like, if something doesn't kill you, it doesn't necessarily make it stronger. It might just make you weaker for the next thing to kill you. Especially since we have, you know, in this country, we have not, our excess deaths have not gone down to our pre-pandemic levels. So that would kind of suggest that long COVID is something that we're kind of just pushing under the rug.
Jessica, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Sala, unfortunate for Jessica, but I'm guessing this is the kind of story you hear a lot from patients there at Northwestern.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things I would highlight there is that it sounds like based on her 3-year duration, she was probably one of the individuals early in the pandemic who acquired the illness, very likely pre-vaccine era sort of thing. And so, but that in itself is actually not unheard of. And in fact, you know, it's actually quite common where someone got an infection 3 years on, they're still struggling with a lot of the cognitive issues, especially, and this idea of having subsequent flares when someone gets a respiratory illness or you know, on a given day is also a pretty stereotype phenomenon as well.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Dr. Saul, I want to focus on one thing she mentioned, fatigue. And I think sometimes I hear the word fatigue and think, oh yeah, we're all a little sleepy sometimes. As I, at least in things I've read, the people experiencing long COVID, fatigue means something pretty different and really life-limiting in some cases. How big a symptom has that been?
Yeah, there's two things I would separate out there. One is fatigue, where sometimes people describe it as, you know, they'll be going about their day and then they just feel a profound, you know, a need to just kind of lie down and maybe not even sleep, to be honest with you, just lie down and take a break for a second there. There's that fatigue. And then there's also something I would just kind of be a little bit more nuanced about, which is what I call exercise intolerance, where a lot of people maybe were previously very athletic, marathon runners in some cases, where they really cannot get back to their prior pace or clip when it comes back to activity. And sometimes when they do try to push it to 100% of what they knew as their baseline is when they can really suffer for the next several days. And that's actually kind of a phenomenon we refer to as exercise intolerance or post-exertional malaise, where that sort of activity kind of hits them hardest. So two slightly different twists on the same concept, but definitely important to kind of tease out as the provider.
Dr. Saul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for sharing your research with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Mark Saul, Assistant Professor of Pulmonary and Critical Care at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Co-Director of the Northwestern Medicine Comprehensive COVID-19 Center. He talked to us about a new analysis of just over 1,800 long COVID patients who have been treated at the center. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, getting older can bring a lot of changes and challenges. Get a lot of advice on meeting those challenges with the author of the new book, The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. And Wisconsin is expected to be a swing state in the presidential election again. Why has Wisconsin stayed on the seesaw while so many states have moved on to the Democratic or Republican columns? Longtime state politics writer joins the show. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Smaller cities are undergoing redevelopment to attract residents after the pandemic changed the way many of us work. We'll talk to an urban planning expert about his new book on the good and bad from the ways our cities are changing. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a bit, a law and politics expert here in Wisconsin explains this week's indictment of former President Donald Trump for his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Now, police pursuits are becoming more common in Milwaukee. The city's police department engaged in more than 1,000 chases last year, an average of nearly 3 a day. And Jonah Chester reports that as chases have increased, so have injuries to innocent third parties.
On August 1, 2019, 19-year-old Laquan McCoy was driving through an intersection on Milwaukee's north side. Another driver in a stolen SUV blew through a flashing red light going about 70 miles per hour and into the driver's side of McCoy's car. The impact sent McCoy's Jeep into a tree on one side of the road and a parked car on the other, killing him. Antoinette Broomfield is McCoy's mother.
My husband ended up passing away from stress, from a heart attack, from just constantly being in pain and worrying about it. My other children, my daughter, she's not the same. She's different. My son, he's not the same. Everybody is grieving.
Aaron Fitzgerald was driving that stolen SUV and fleeing police. He got a 10-year prison sentence and 8 years of extended supervision for McCoy's death. But Broomfield's quest for accountability didn't end with his imprisonment. She's suing the city of Milwaukee and the four officers who pursued Fitzgerald. Sitting with her attorney, she says those officers could have called off the chase earlier, avoiding the tragedy.
Oh, some days I just don't even want to get out the bed. Some days it's just bad. Some days I just wake up and I just wish it all was a dream. I know everybody make a mistake, but why could I even just get an apology that it happened to my child?
Broomfield's lawsuit comes as police chases in Milwaukee are becoming more common. Annual pursuit rates in the early 2010s generally hovered around 50 chases a year. In both 2021 and 2022, officers pursued more than 1,000 suspects. Pursuit reform advocates attribute that surge to the department's current chase policy. It allows officers to pursue for more offenses like reckless driving. In the early 2010s, the department had a stricter policy. Officers could usually only chase those suspected of a felony. Craig Sarnow is an inspector with the Milwaukee Police Department. He says policy changes through the 2010s allowed officers to address drug dealing, reckless driving, carjacking, and other crimes.
We used to have individuals that would try to bait Milwaukee police officers into getting into pursuits, knowing full well that we couldn't because our policy was so restrictive.
But advocates say a looser chase policy also puts more innocent people, like Laquan McCoy, at risk. From 2007 to 2022, uninvolved bystanders were injured in more than three times as many police chases as officers were. And that data may not provide the full picture. Jonathan Ferris is the chief advocate for the Wisconsin-based Pursuit for Change. He says police chase data is often inaccurate.
Most of us who have been following this for a fair number of years have seen more than enough examples of pursuits that were not logged as pursuits.
And police departments do have other options. Things like high-tech trackers, tire deflation tools, and even a grappling device that allows an officer to entangle a fleeing vehicle and slow it down. But MPD Chief of Staff Nicholas Desiato told the city's Fire and Police Commission last summer that many of those alternatives are, quote, practically impractical.
They can be effective when appropriate, but it also requires incredible coordination and sometimes just dumb luck. In terms of a hot pursuit to effectively combat reckless driving, it's just a necessary tool.
Sarnow says the department is open to reviewing the current chase policy, but he doesn't expect it to change anytime soon. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Now, the pandemic changed how and where many of us decided to live, and cities of all sizes have adapted to their changing demographics and economies. With remote workers having more freedom to choose their location, the cities themselves have been competing to attract a class of younger professionals who often tend to be higher-paid white-collar workers. Many cities have invested in urban renewal and new development to provide the amenities these workers are seeking, and some are turning to social media influencers to market their downtowns. Our next guest says these campaigns often leave a lot of people out and lead to lots of different communities trying to market themselves in unique, all in roughly the same way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your city, big or small, grow and redevelop in recent years? What do you think the identity of your local community is? Have you been part of an effort to rebrand, do placemaking in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David A. Banks is a lecturer in the Geography and Planning Department at the University at Albany, SUNY. He's the author of the new book, The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the details, I want to throw one more concept onto the table here. This one goes back before COVID, and this went to a lot of cities, the idea that, hey, to rebuild, especially maybe in a post-industrial rust belt type of city, we need to attract the creative class. We need to make an attractive community for these young professionals to come into. Can you talk a little bit about that notion? Because I think it's a key to your argument in the book here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really kind of the beginning of the story, right? Is that after deindustrialization in the United States, and this also happens in Europe, is that cities don't know where to turn for investment dollars and for, in terms of like tax revenue or, you know, employment opportunities for its citizens. And so there's really just a policy vacuum there. And then in the 90s, that vacuum is filled by several attempts, but what really sticks, you know, they're all kind of similar, but what really sticks is Richard Florida's 2002 mega hit, The Rise of the Creative Class. And what the argument basically says is, yeah, what you just described, that people, especially high income earning creative professionals, are highly mobile. And for that reason, you know, the way to capture the value that they create is to make them happy and to find, you know, fun things for them to do and just generally make them comfortable. And so a lot of cities did that and saw some success. But what happened in a lot of cases was that you kind of got like a tail that wags the dog sort of situation, where you make this downtown, or you put a lot of investment dollars in a fun downtown, but the creatives never come. And then you also then have a bunch of small business owners that probably go out of business because the clientele is just not there.
You focus in your work on small to mid-sized cities in upstate New York. I think there are probably comparable stories to be told in similar sized cities here in Wisconsin. In effect, there's this weird paradox where all these communities, you know, they're competing with big cities for people. And they're saying, we're going to make our own unique identity. But they're all doing it in many cases, it seems like you're saying, in very similar ways to each other. How has that played out?
Yeah, one of the longest examples that I have in the book that is not in upstate New York is Milwaukee. Because maybe people listening from Milwaukee might remember this. Probably a little less than 10 years ago, there was a design podcast called 99% Invisible that did a show about city flags, you know, like the flag that a city has. And Milwaukee's was rated one of the ugliest because it has it actually has like
it has
a flag.
Everything. It has everything on it.
Yeah. It's a whole kitchen sink full of stuff, including another flag, like on the flag. Mm-hmm. Incredible stuff. And so the end of the episode basically like calls for people to like redesign their city flags as a sort of civic boosterism. And in Milwaukee, a young graphic designer makes a flag and presents it. I think they calls it like the people's flag. And it gains some traction, but it also gets understandably, there's a pushback because, it's the creative professional that showed up that likes Milwaukee, but maybe is not from there. I don't recall if he was born there or not. But quickly, the flag conversation gets turned into a conversation about who belongs and who gets to say they are part of Milwaukee. And it's a conversation of class and race in that. And it never really came to a full conclusion as far as I understand. But, you know, that is a little anecdote for the way that cities are rebranding all across the country and in other places around the world, where they recognize that the city has to in some ways act like a brand in that. They have to cultivate a personality or a reputation of some kind that exists beyond their borders and that is both welcoming, but also unique, right? And sometimes uniqueness can be off-putting or just intimidating. And so the thing that cities try to strike in their brand management is what I call predictably unique, where you just give a little riff on what is widely kind of understood is just kind of like small town, small city pride.
Social media is a newer part of this story since the original creative class book came out. And you see in your book and your research, some communities, community leaders and others trying to become influencers in effect and going with a sort of online influencer playbook. What kind of things do you see?
Yeah, social media intersects in a lot of interesting ways. And if we just want to keep it to influencers, there's a few different kinds, right? The one is like your homegrown influencer, someone that becomes popular on their own through whatever mechanism is at their disposal to become popular on whatever social media site they've chosen. And sometimes that can kind of bring everyone with them and raise the profile of the city, right? So one example from around me is, you know, there's a small group of people that have like video short kind of series that's on several different platforms, and they've sort of started merging into traditional media, the newspapers and local television. And in that way, you know, like they're not only like getting the capital region out there, they're getting the they're telling people within the capital region about new things that are happening. Now, another example would be, you know, something like Baltimore, or Washington, D.C., both of those cities are right next to each other, but both of them independently had ideas of like, well, we will go to a talent agency and hire influencers that already have an audience with the kind of demographic that we want to attract, and we will basically pay them to have a weekend trip in our city, and that will heighten the profile of our city in these core demographics that we've identified that we want to attract. And then the third one is something that I called like place-based memes or memes of place, and this is where people make usually jokes, a lot of the times they're self-deprecating, about what it's like to live in a place. And in those cases, you know, it'll be like, you know, a common one is like the starter pack, where you say, you know, name of city, starter pack. And then it's just a collection of items, mostly mass market consumer goods, that are supposed to reflect the kind of people that live in a place.
We're talking to geography and planning lecturer David Banks about his new book. It's called The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where you live, what kind of growth, what kind of changes have you seen in your area? Do you see this kind of outreach to bring in younger professionals? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's changing your community in ways you're not always on board with? What does it mean to live in the place you live in? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see your local community, or the state of Wisconsin for that matter, marketed? How should communities reach out to draw in people? Are you bugged by the way you've seen these things happen, maybe where you live or used to live? What lured you, if you came from out of state, to your community in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, I don't want to miss this point of your book. You see a lot of downsides to the stuff, the kinds of outreach we're talking about. One of them is, and other people have brought this up over the years, is, okay, if this outreach to young professionals is successful, it brings people in. One concern is that so they have more money, they drive up the costs of rent and goods and services, and the people who already live there get squeezed out. How big a part of the problem is that?
Yeah, it's big. It's really big, right? So, and I don't want to make it seem like there is an obvious, easy answer out there that people just choose not to pick up, because that's not the case. It's very difficult, especially when pretty much all of our land is out in a marketplace, right? To keep prices affordable while also making a more desirable product, right? Because like everything else, as you make things nicer and better, they're going to have more value, and that value is going to be reflected in the cost of rent or the, you know, median house price, right? And so a lot of the times you become a victim of your own success if you do make your town or your neighborhood or your city, you know, that much better. You're going to have a hard time retaining the people that still live there and let them benefit from that rising tide. Now, one thing that you see that's even more pernicious than that is that oftentimes the increase in land values also undermines the very thing that might make the place desirable in the first place. Is it right? So I think a lot of people, especially if they've lived in a very large city, have experienced this, where a neighborhood that used to be very funky and had like lots of artists and lots of interesting things happening gets noticed. And then the experimental kind of places become coffee shops, and then the coffee shops become art studios or art galleries, and then you get, and then stuff starts turning into like the Bank of America, and then there's a lot more chain stores, and eventually the thing that was that the spark that was there is now gone, and what's replaced it are like chain stores and like expensive lofts, right? And that's that happens all over the place, and it's a very robust phenomenon. And so that tells us that that's going to happen absent direct intervention. And there's some tools on the table, but nothing that's used widespread that works 100% of the time.
Another concern, a little more subtle, I think, in your book, David, is who is at the table? Who's deciding what the identity of a community is? Who is doing the outreach? And you suggest, I think, that a lot of people are left out, as you mentioned with the Milwaukee flag debate. What did you see as you looked at those communities in New York?
Yeah. So now I'm gonna be kind of New York specific here, with the one caveat that a lot of states in the United States have something similar to this, right? The jurisdictions will be different. How you get on the various committees will be different, and a bunch of other things. But I'm not fluent in Wisconsin.
Sure.
Government, but here's what happens in New York, is that there are 10 regional economic development councils that compete with each other sometimes, but mostly carry on competitions parallel to each other within their respective areas, right? And this is good for a place like New York State, where you have obviously New York City, which is much different, much denser, much richer than a Schenectady, a Rochester, or like the Southern tier. And so by setting up these parallel competitions, you do get a little bit more democracy in this, or more places get a shot at the big prize, which is lots of state money, either in the form of direct grants or low to no interest loans, is usually the structure of the assistance. And and those grants and loans are spread across lots of different programs that have lots of different goals. Everything from bolstering the state's agriculture celebrating the history of the Erie Canal, right, and everything in between. And what happens is usually a city, a nonprofit, or a for-profit business will apply for anywhere from 5 to 7 figures of aid in order to do a certain kind of economic development project. And then the council in each region gets to rate their applications. And who sits on the council are appointed by the governor, and they are almost always the high-level executive or owner or president of a bank, a hospital, or a university are a lot of the big ones. And then there are also large manufacturers if they're in the area, or some sort of large employer, and a couple of successful entrepreneurs, right? But these are appointed by the governor, and they make their decisions, and they make their decisions out in the open. But you could also criticize this as just sort of like taking those smoky backroom backslapping deals and just like taking meeting minutes, but you haven't changed anything important. You've just kind of like made it a little bit more transparent. But the end result is that, these appointees are picking winners and losers. But in the process, they are trying to say that everyone that they did pick meets some sort of broader goal or vision that the council has articulated. And in that way, we take what we call a market economy and we plan it, right? We by region, based on what some of the more powerful actors in that regional economy think the rest of the region should act like or behave like.
And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. Coming up, former President Donald Trump was indicted yesterday on 4 felony charges for his role in attempting to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election. We'll dig into the charges and what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.